Well, we've considered a lot of things this few days about Jesus of Nazareth. We've watched him on campus as we looked at who God is, as he modeled him for us. We don't know any God except the one he showed us, his Father. And he's a beautiful God. He's a God of the second chance, as we noticed this morning. He's a God who runs to meet you. He's a God who likes the clean cup inside as well as out. He's a God that loves little children. All of these things describe him, and we've noticed those. We've also noticed things that were difficult to believe, things that stretch us way beyond ourselves, as we heard him make claims to deity, things that would ordinarily cause a man to be captured and put in an insane asylum or to be dismissed as an egomaniac, but things which upon his lips fit very naturally and cause us to wonder. And then we saw things about him that are so appealing, our hearts reach out and we say, that's what I want. He's right. He's absolutely right. And there are things about him that even unbelievers recognize are true. Atheists and agnostics and enemies and critics have all bowed down before him and have said, you know, say what you will about him, this man makes sense. And to you and me, our hearts reached out and said, he's saying things and he's doing things and he is something that I would not live without if I could, and I could not live without if I would. And so we've considered those things, and I think we've been caught between them. And we've been brought to the tension that creates faith in us. Perhaps we've been made a little bit uneasy, and that's from God, so don't fight that. But in the midst of all of that, we find our attention captured by what I would like to call an irresistible sight. A lone cross erected upon a barren hill, an innocent man dying for very, very guilty people. And that's always been irresistible. It was so startling and so stunning that the ones who were the observers went home smiting their breasts, realizing that they had committed or at least witnessed something that was so unjust that it was beyond description, and all that could be described was a smiting of themselves. And they went home and left him there. It's difficult for us to grasp it, and I don't come tonight playing like you grasp or understand the cross. It's difficult for us to grasp because it's not an American form of execution. It's Roman. It's not modern. It's 2,000 years since it happened. And it's horrible beyond description. I don't know that there's anything about it really that makes it easy to grasp as far as the instrument itself. So I'm not going to make you feel bad because you seem to be detached from it. I've felt detached from the cross of Christ for 35 years as far as the instrument is concerned. I don't know that I can grasp the scope of it. I don't think you can either. Do you identify with me in this, that whenever you consider this man who lived in an entirely different age, another race entirely, you have difficulty grasping the scope of what is claimed for his very unique death? Do you have trouble grasping that he died for the whole world? I do. I always have. I used to think I was a nut. I used to think I was hopeless. And this was after I'd been preaching for 15 years. I used to ride myself and say, what's wrong with you that you can't be moved emotionally by the statement that he died not only for our sins but for the sins of the whole world? And I couldn't grasp it. And it was years before I realized what was the matter. I was not emotionally capable of grasping the implications of that dimension of the cross. I wasn't built emotionally deep enough or wide enough to grasp it and to be responsive to it in a way that would be commensurate with its dimension. He died for the whole world. I can't grasp that. I can't understand the whole world. So why should I be able to grasp his dying for the whole world? And finally, I got off my back But it wasn't I that got off my back. I read something that reduced it to a size that I could grasp. One day I was reading in the book of Luke, and I read the statement, the record there. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not even fear God, since you're under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." The day I saw the thief and the way Jesus treated him while he was dying, that's the day I got a handle on what the cross meant. Prior to that, I had felt like someone trying to get his arms around the stadium over here, or the Gainas Athletic Center. And it's as though someone were to take me over there and say, "I want you to get your arms around that athletic center." And I would say, "I beg your pardon?" They'd say, "Yeah, we've brought you down here now. It's some considerable expense and an airline ticket and all that. We want you to go over there and put your arms around that center." And I would say, "Well, man, I understand what you're saying, and I'm not denying that it's there, but I'm just simply telling you I'm not made like that. I'm hooked up here at the shoulders, and I'm not plastic man, and I just can't get around it." And I can imagine you'd say, "Oh, well, I should have known better than to brought you down here anyway." And in desperation and just exasperation, they say, "Do you think, you see that door on the athletic center, do you think you can go up there and get your hand on that handle? I said, "Yeah, I can do that." And so I go up there and get my hand on the handle, and I open the door, and I walk in through the door into that vast expanse of that great big athletic center. And I stand there in awe at the expanse of it. Well, that's normal. That's natural. Buildings like that weren't made to put your arms around. They were made to walk through and enjoy the expanse. That's what the purpose of it is. The same thing is true of the cross. Crosses were not made to get your arms around emotionally. I'm convinced that there's not that much said in the scriptures where it was intended for that to be the purpose of the cross. It's told with too direct language. It's told with too much objectivity. It's told with too little detail as far as the agonizing adjective. There's just not all that much. In fact, it's told with such detachment as to leave you saying, "Well, is that all there is?" And if you're looking for an emotional high that comes through adjective description and a horrible definition of all the implications of the suffering and all, if you're looking for that, you can forget it. It's not there. But you see, the cross wasn't intended to be that anyway. I don't think it was intended to be an emotional hype by which we become so elevated in our emotion that we become emotionalistic. I don't think it was intended to be that. Crosses weren't made for that. But when I saw that one example, when I saw what he did while he was on the cross, a whole new window opened up for me, a whole new world opened up for me. You know what a microcosm is? You know what a microcosm is? Well, on a TV screen, you know what a little window down in the corner is? Where they've taken out of the big scene, they've zeroed in and taken a camera, and they have taken a telephoto lens, and they've zoomed in on one particular little scene, and they have magnified that right there in the corner. While this whole big scene is taking place, they have zeroed in on one thing that is of importance, and they've let you see that. That's something like what a microcosm is. It's a miniature of the whole huge scene that we can't grasp all at once, but it boils it down, it reduces it, and it lets us look at it in miniature. That's what the thief on the cross did for me. It happened some 15, some 20 years ago. But I saw in the miniature, I saw in the way Jesus treated the thief, I saw what the cross meant. And all of a sudden, for me, there came rushing into me an understanding of what it meant for Jesus to die for the whole world. I couldn't grasp his dying for the whole world, but I'll guarantee you I was able to grasp what he did for the thief while he was dying for the whole world. And when he turned to that thief and said, "Today, you're going to be with me in paradise," that to me was the most beautiful event that I have ever seen. And it didn't take away from the cross. It illustrated the cross. It defined the cross. It described the cross. It broke open the cross. It became a little handle for me on the cross so that I could walk up to it, use it as a way of getting into the cross, and then walk into and be awed by the spaciousness and the expanse of the grace of God. And that's what I did. That's what the cross, that's what his treatment of the thief on the cross did for me. And that day when I saw that, when I heard the thief be bold enough to not even let this man die in peace, and when I heard him say, "Jesus, Jesus, would you remember me when you come in your kingdom?" And I heard that man almost say, "I believe there's another gift here." And almost, you know, within his heart, he reached down in that big old bag of gifts that he came to bring, and there was another one there with this man's name on it. And he said, "Today, you're going to be with me." You know what those words "with me" meant to that man? "You're going to be with me today in paradise." I often think of this man, and I think of who he is and who he was. And we don't know who he was. We don't know what he looked like. We don't know his name. We know he was guilty. We know he was an opportunist. We know he was ignorant. He didn't know anything about the kingdom. Good grief. His own disciples, Jesus' own disciples, didn't know very much about it, and they'd been with him 24 hours a day for 3 years. How on earth could this man coming on the scene at this particular one time be expected to know anything about the kingdom? He had heard something about it, sure. And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom." But he didn't know anything about the kingdom. He didn't know much about Jesus, except that he knew enough to know that the man was not guilty, that he had no reason to be where he was. But he was faceless, he was nameless, he was worthless. He didn't have but about 30 minutes left. He was ignorant, he was an opportunist, he was grabbing for straws. He was at an extreme position where he was going to do anything that he could possibly do. And Jesus knew all of that. There's no way on earth that you can describe a man further away from God than this thief was. There's not a place you could go. There's not a dimension you could explore. He was ignorant, he was faceless, he was nameless, he was worthless, he was guilty. And in spite of all of that, and perhaps because of all of that, because he threw himself upon the mercy of Jesus Christ, the Lord simply, absolutely stretched himself all the way to that man, and he said, "Today you're going to be with me in paradise." Now I guarantee you, that's beautiful. I often think, and I just, you know, your mind wanders. And I've often thought when the time came that Jesus died, and he died before this thief. And you can almost hear the thief say, "Wait a minute, don't leave me." You know, here he went, and the thief was not dying. And they said, "Break their legs," and so they did. But Jesus, you might think, was standing over there in his spirit under a tree waiting on this man to exit. And he had to wait a while, and so he waited because he said, "I'm going to take you with me." What do you think he did? Went without him? Of course not. He waited for him. And finally, when the thief died, you can just see Jesus beckoning him and saying, "Come on, hurry up, let's go. We've got to get out of here." And he took him on his arm, and I've often thought as they walked into the presence of the Father, I've often thought the Father must have looked down at his son and this fellow on his arm, and I can imagine the Father saying, "Where in the world did you get that?" And Jesus would have said, "Well, I met him today out there back of the bus station, the Egged bus tour station. That's where Golgotha's located now. Just a dump where they throw oil cans and spare parts, and it's a rubbish heap." And that's what it was back there. But he said, "I found him today. I came across him today. I met him today out there behind that bus station," or, "I met him out there on that hill, that garbage dump." But then he would have said, "But wait, Father, you would have done the same thing. You would have brought him with you." And there would have been this silence, And this big smile would have broken out on the father's face, and he would have said, "You're right. Bring him on in." And then I just thought that the angels began doing backflips and didos. As one brother described it, there had been angel feathers all over the throne room. Another one had been brought home. That's what it means to me. That's why it's so special to me. Because you know whose name is written across that man's face? Mine. My name is across his face because I'm just as guilty as he. At my life, when I became a follower of Jesus, I was just as worthless, I was just as faceless, I was just as nameless, I was just as self-centered in the sense that I was opportunistic, I was hurting, I was trying to find some solution to my life. It was almost totally turned inward. There's nothing noble about my conversion. Everything about it simply says, you're an opportunistic, you're... The whole thing could be said about me. So I'm not sure that... I wasn't able to grasp it except as I grasped that little miniature. And once I saw that microcosm of that was happening, and I realized that's what the whole world is receiving. And I don't know why. Why did he choose to record that one little miniature? Why did he choose to do it? I think because it's so descriptive. I think it's because it's so descriptive of what was happening on that broad scene that you and I never would be able to grasp because we're not emotionally capable of it. So he reduced it down to that little doorknob that opens up into the grace of God, and he says, "Come on, I want to show you something. I want to show you what it means." And he slung the door open, and we walked in through the way Jesus treated that thief, and we realized that when he came and died and did what he did, he really did do that for people. It was just at the right time, while we were weak, that Christ died for the ungodly, Paul says. And then he just as though to shake his head, he said, "Why, people won't even die for a godly man, for a good man." Oh, it might be that one would be bold enough to dare to die for a good man, but he said God commended his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And it just left Paul just shaking his head, thinking, "My, my." But it opened up a whole new dimension for me. Because there's a third thing. I say, first of all, it was difficult for us to grasp because it's not American and all of that. But we'll get over that. You can span that barrier. You can bridge the gap. And you can come to grips with that. And it's difficult for us to grasp because of the enormity of it and the size of it. It's beyond our emotional capabilities, but he's reduced that to a miniature so that we can even see that. And I'm now on track with that. I understand it. And I love it. And I believe I'll go to my deathbed never, ever failing to appreciate, and not ever will I get to the place where I don't find my fingers wanting to flip back there to the 23rd chapter of Luke and listen to that man say again, "Would you remember me when you come in your kingdom?" And then hear Jesus turn to that man and say, "Today, you'll be with me." But you see, there's a third part, and it's this that opened this up. It's not just that it is miniature, that's part of it. But the other part of it is that in this beautiful miniature, or in this beautiful little offset where we can see the meaning of the big one, we don't just see a miniature, we see something else. We see the quality of the life of the person who died. That's why it's so moving. It could have been a miniature, and the question could have been asked, "Jesus, would you remember me when you come in your kingdom?" And he could have said, "Why in the world don't you leave me alone? Can't I have 5 minutes to die to myself? You've been pulling on my goodness." And then you would have realized, this man, he's beyond himself and he can't control himself. And that would have exploded the whole thing. But it's not that. It's the quality of his life so that you know who it is that died. You know why it is? One of the reasons why you've not been able maybe to be moved by the death of Jesus? You don't know Jesus. And I'm not giving that as a blanket indictment. I'm just simply saying that one of the reasons why we haven't been able to really and truly be moved by the death of this man is that we haven't known the man. There's nothing magical about somebody dying on a cross. In that fact, there's nothing magical about somebody dying. Some years ago up in Missouri, do you remember the time that there was a man there that the police had cornered in a barn? I remember reading about it, and it just simply says that the police came in on this man, and they finally shot him to death in the barn, and he died there on the spot. I remember reading it in the papers, and it didn't move me to one tear. It didn't even move me emotionally. I had no response to it whatsoever. Well, you say, you're pretty callous. I don't think I am. The only problem was I didn't know the man that was shot. You know, we see so many shootings, we see so many deaths, and we see so much violence. Maybe all of us have become callous. But I'll guarantee you, if that newspaper headline had said David Woodruff was shot in a barn, I guarantee you there would have been an emotional response to that. Why? Because I know him. Or if it had been that one of you, whom I have learned to love over the years, if it had been that you were shot, that you were cornered and shot like a wild animal in a barn, I guarantee you I would have shed tears there. It would have torn me apart emotionally simply because of the fact that I know the man. I know you. And I'm convinced that whenever we know the man that died on the cross, I'm convinced that when we come to know him, and then we just simply turn and say, now that's the man that died for you, then you're going to feel it then. You're going to be able to respond emotionally. Who was he? Well, he was a man that was always laying his life down for other folks. He was a man that this man who died with him said, this man has done nothing worthy of death. He's not guilty. The man that we're watching, that history has recorded, that we're seeing in this spectacle, that we're seeing in this little microcosm, the way he treated folks, we're seeing that that's the way he always treated people. He was always laying his life down for people long before he got to Golgotha. In addition to the thief on the cross and the way he treated him, there were the men who executed him. And watch him now and see if you can pick up on the lifestyle that he lived, because his death is meaningful really only because of the life that he lived. He lived the way he died, and he died the way he lived, and because of the way he lived his life, we are able to sense the nature of his death. Look at this man as he began to talk and as he began to take into consideration the people that were around him. The people that were most imposed upon him and upon his attention were those who were executing him. And a very brief sentence and a very brief prayer to his father said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I'll bet that's the first time those men had ever heard those words. Usually they heard someone curse and swear and say, I'll get you if it's the last thing I do. You dirty, and just all the vile cursings and swearings. And all of a sudden, this one stood up in history and this unique person arose and simply said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. But it's not just there. You can go back through his life and you can find people whom he befriended. And in all of these cases, he laid his life down for them. Now, these are all familiar cases, and you can fill in the details. But you remember the woman that was taken in adultery? How he laid his life down for her? You see, his life was at stake. They really weren't interested in her life. They would either, you know, snuff it out or keep it. But they were really interested in her only as a means of getting to him. And they brought this poor soul, being goaded in as they would like a cow or some animal, and goaded toward Jesus. They weren't going to touch her. She was a sinner. And they came while he was teaching in the temple, and they herded her down toward the front, and there the people let them through, and there she slumped down with the sheet over her head, probably trying to hide her face. And they said, this woman we caught in the act of adultery. Now Moses says, stoner. What do you say, Jesus? And you know, he stooped down and began to write in the sand, and they thought they had him. You can just see them poking each other saying, this is it. We've got him. He doesn't know the answer. Look at him. He's stalling. And so they kept saying, What do you say? Shall we stone her or shall we not stone her? Moses says, stone her. What do you say? And Jesus, you know, looked up and gave that priceless jewel upon which you and I hang our hat. He said, let him that's without sin among you cast the first stone. And then he stooped back down and began to write again. And they left. But you see, he risked his life there. He excused the woman. He forgave her and sent her away to sin no more. He said, go on and don't you sin anymore now.
But they were trying to get him, and they thought they had him on the horns of this dilemma. If he said stoner, he was in trouble. If he says don't stoner, he was in trouble. Either way, they thought they had him. But then he reversed the verdict and simply said, well, go ahead, let him that's without sin cast the first one. Or it was a person, say, like Zacchaeus, who was up the tree. He risked his personality, he risked his reputation on Zacchaeus. As he was making his way down through the dusty street in Jericho, and he came to this place where this man had gotten a principal seat. He couldn't see. He was a belt buckles was all he could see. He was a little short fella. And he thought, well, I'll go down the way a while. And he climbed up in a tree in all of his regalia, all of his robes, all of his honor, all of what dignity he had. And he lost it. When he climbed up in the tree, he looked like a bird of paradise, I guess, up there, looking down on the Lord. And Jesus knew who he was, and he said, called him by name. He said, Zacchaeus, come on down. I've got to go home with you today. And it just floored this man, and he came down. He made haste, came down, and went home with Jesus. Jesus and Zacchaeus arm in arm. And you know what the religious people said? Shocking. He's gone home to be the man, a guest of a man that's a sinner. Shocking. Jesus just kind of said over his shoulder, you can imagine, well, he's a son of Abraham too. I've come to call the sinners to repentance. He's a son of Abraham too. Took him home, went in the house. Zacchaeus was so overwhelmed with this gesture of kindness, he just simply stood up to make an announcement. He said, I'm going to give half of my goods to feed the poor, and if I've taken anything from anybody unjustly, he said, I'm going to restore it fourfold. But Jesus risked his reputation with this man, but he had already been ruined anyway. 2 or 3 years earlier, they'd already said he's a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Shocking. That's right. Hosts of others he laid his life down for. The aged. You remember when he was talking to the people of the Jewish nation, the religious leaders? And they had come to him and said, your disciples aren't keeping the traditions of Moses. They're eating without washing their hands. And Jesus said, and why are you breaking the law of God with your tradition? For Moses said, honor your father and mother. And whoever does not honor father and mother, or whoever speaks ill of father and mother, let him die the death. But you say, if any man says to his father or his mother, that wherewith you would have been blessed by me has been given to God, it's Korban. You no longer allow a man to honor his father, you hypocrites. He said, well, did Isaiah speak of you? And he just tore into them because of the fact that they were trying to find a way to get around helping their mothers and daddies. And as a result, he said, you have made null and void the word of God by your traditions. On that occasion, it says the Pharisees went out immediately, took counsel with the Herodians how to kill him, how to destroy him. He risked his life for the aged people. He risked his life for the poor people. They were ripped off by religionists. You know, religion has always had a tendency to rip people off who were poor. It's no different back here. Jesus came and saw it and was infuriated by the fact that here were religious people who should have been blessing and who should have been helping poor people. Here they were bleeding them. Here they were strapping them with burdens and financial cares. And Jesus saw what they were doing in the temple. He saw them out in there robbing the poor people, charging 7 times as much as you could get a dove outside the temple. Go inside the temple where it had the stamp of the priest upon it. Cost you 7 times as much to get an approved sacrifice. It made him so mad. He went out. It was Sunday afternoon when he saw that happening in the temple. He went out with his mind working so fast. He went to Bethany, spent the night with Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Before he went to bed, maybe that night, he said, Mary, do you have any strips of leather that I could have? Mary said, I don't know. Ask Martha. So he would ask Martha, do you have any strips of leather that I could have? I've got a job to do. She said, yeah, go down the hall. It's the second door on the right and look up on the third nail on the left. And there's a, you know, she knew where all that was. Martha did. But anyway, he came back into the temple, into the city that next morning early. And he came in there with this whip that he had made. And he began to swing that thing and overturn tables and drive people out. And by the way, all the money running every direction. And he said, how dare you make my father's house a den of thieves? And boy, he began to tamper with their purse strings, and they hated him for it. He risked his life for the poor people. He risked his life for sinners. He risked his life for the old people. He risked his life for the sick. On one occasion in Mark, there was this woman who'd been bent over for 18 years, couldn't stand up. It was a Saturday. But he didn't care whether it was a Saturday or not. He knew this woman had been in misery and pain for 18 years. Watch him risk his life. They were watching him to see whether he would heal her on the Sabbath or not. And maybe it was 30 minutes until sundown. He could have said to her, honey, 30 minutes and I'll take care of you. Let's not worry. Let's not get him upset. No, he said, essentially 18 years is long enough. Come on. And he brought her there and he said, you're freed from your infirmity. And he lifted her up. And all the people, it says, they glorified God at all the wonderful things he was doing. Except the old chief of the synagogue said, hold on a minute. Hold on, said, there are 6 days on which work ought to be done. You come on one of those days to be healed and not on the Sabbath. That was the wrong answer. Jesus said, you hypocrite, which of you having an ox or an ass will not loose it from the stall and lead it away to water on the Sabbath? Should not this woman whom Satan has bound for lo these 18 years be loosed from her bondage on the Sabbath? And it says all of his adversaries were put to shame, and I should think they were. But I'll guarantee you what happened. They hated him for it. But the reason why I'm recounting all of these is so you can see the kind of man that he was. See the way he lived his life. See the way he laid his life down. The way he was careful for little children. The way he was careful for sinners. The way he lived among them. And the way he ate among them. The way he lived his life. And if you get in there and know him enough personally, then when you find him dying upon the cross and you find him doing the same thing to the thief and saying the same thing to the thief in the same spirit that he said to the people who were afflicted that he met every day, all those little miniature crosses all back through his life were just simply saying, this man is the man that lays his life down for everybody. He gives himself to everybody. Then when the news is broken, Jesus of Nazareth was executed today. That's why it becomes so meaningful. Why on earth would they kill a man like that? Well, they couldn't stand him. He was a threat to them. What about you? You know enough about him to be touched by his death? 20 years ago, I came to a conclusion. I had learned enough about Jesus of Nazareth to know that's the man I want to follow. You know, aside from whatever it may be that I can't grab a hold of, I knew one thing, I was going to follow somebody. You're not ever going to be your own God. Somebody's going to rule over you. I came to a conclusion. I had come to know enough about Jesus of Nazareth to know that if following Jesus of Nazareth meant that I would die and go to hell, if he were there with me, that's all I cared. 20 years has passed by and I still believe the same thing, still hold to the same belief. You could call hell whatever you want. If Jesus is there, send me to hell. You can call heaven anything you want. If Jesus isn't there, please don't send me to heaven. I don't want to be anywhere where he isn't. I believe that tonight. What about you? Do you know enough about him to be able to make that statement? Has it rung a bell in you? Has his life so met reality that you see, by the way, that's right. I know enough about him to know that I want him to be the one leading me. And I'm willing to follow him to hell if that's necessary. Do you know him well enough to say that? What will you do with him? And all I'm going to say, and we're going to offer the invitation and ask you to stand in a minute and answer this question, but you're going to have to answer it based upon how much you know about him. If it's just like the woman that said overseas when they asked her, do you believe that he's the Son of God? She said, well, that's what they say about him. That's not good enough. Do you know him well enough to say, simple though it may be, I know enough about him to know that I want to follow him. And I know enough about him to know that I resent terribly the fact that they killed him. I know enough about him to know that I love him. Now, if you know that much, and if you're willing to make a commitment to somebody, if you know enough about him to know that that's the way I want to live my life, that's the way I want to spend my life. You've only got one, and you're going to serve somebody. Has the penny dropped in your thinking yet to where you can say, that's the man I want to follow? What must I do? Well, there's a very simple process. If you've already come to faith, if this tension has brought you to the place where you've come to the place that you've said, yeah, that's the man I want to follow, how can I go about it? Well, you start off through entering a similar door that he entered, of dying to yourself, being buried, and being raised. It's called baptism. You mean he doesn't ask me to bring any money? No, except all you've got. But that doesn't have to be more than 2 cents or a penny or nothing. But he wants all of you. But you mean he doesn't require anything but for me just to come and make my confession of faith and be immersed in That's right. It'll identify you with him, and that's all he wants. He wants you to commit to be with him. Like he committed to be with the thief, he says, I want you to be with me. And that's what he's asking you tonight. What will you do with Jesus? Would you stand? And there may be those who want to come and say, this is my night. I'm coming. Let's stand and sing.